We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Today on the podcast, I speak with Gregory Ruffa, founder and CEO of Sedalis, a company that is transforming the way we interact with each other. Gregory started off in the mortgage broker business, where he learned how to work with others to get stuff done. Gregory then went on to form Corrigo, a platform to help manage facilities with wireless work orders way back in 1999. His time at Corrigo was a wild ride. At one point, it went from 200 people down to 16 in a single day. That taught him a lot about how to manage a business during a downturn, but also the toll that stress and strain can take on you. One of Gregory's proudest technical achievements was keeping Corrigo's cloud services up and running during the early 2000s. Which was the very beginning of cloud computing. To put that in perspective, Amazon Web Services did not even exist back then. Gregory also learned during his 20 years of ups and downs to take things one step at a time, prioritize, and define good people. It was his team that really made it all work. Without a good team that's aligned to the company goals, works well together, and can trust each other, Corrigo would have folded a long time ago. Gregory's new venture, Sedalis, is totally different from real estate management. Sedalis is focused on helping people heal through deep connections with others that take VR to a next level. It's a fascinating idea whose time has come. And if you're interested in how to have transformative experience without using drugs, this is one to listen to. Now, let's get better together. Gregory Ruffa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jerry.
So Gregory's has an interesting business that, of course, I'm going to tease about and we'll get to in a little bit later. But we actually met through Founders Network. I think the first time we met was at the retreat that happened last year. That retreat was pretty enlightening, least of which I got to meet you and talk with you, but there was no power. So we sort of had to this digital detox that none of us thought we would have. And, you know, a bunch of type A founders that, I don't have my email. Got a bit nutty. But before we talk about what you're doing today, I'd like to know kind of how you got to where you are today and how you're doing what you're doing.
Sure. I grew up with a father who was an entrepreneur, and we have a close relationship. But throughout his career as a serial entrepreneur, he always treated myself and my brother as he talked with us like we're adults, and he brought us into his world and thought through his ideas by talking with us. And so it gave us an intimate portrayal of what being an entrepreneur was like, and both the good and the bad. he had success early on, which, you know, he did some really cool things. He was working for IBM in the late 60s, working on commercialization of barcode scanning. And so he took that technology and in the early 70s applied it to library automation. If, you know, anytime in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, checked out a book using barcode scanning, that came about from his company originally. They had some competitors later on, and he sold out his portion of the company in 83. But his company is the first to actually do that and install it in library systems around the world. And so it was computers, it was software, it was the mid 70s, and it was an exciting time.
Oh, so, yeah, that was like the Renaissance. Cool. And so your dad was an entrepreneur, kind of got the bug, I guess, or at least the training. So how did your early career sort of start?
I worked as a programmer for him, and I saw him, through my high school. So my high school was in the late 80s, and college in late 80s and 90s. And I worked as a programmer for him throughout most of that. And I went to college. And when I was done with college, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I got a degree in philosophy, and it wasn't directly applicable to the business world. And
really? So, I would think that philosophy is like the cornerstone of civilization.
Well, it is, and it is applicable. It's just not directly applicable.
Yeah, that's people don't hire you for that.
The philosophize.
Although they should. Maybe there should be a corporate philosopher. You know, I think that'd be a pretty cool job.
Well, I mean, I think most corporations should have corporate ethicists. I mean, I think it's becoming ever more important as we move into the new world that we're moving into, that there are people thinking about really the ethics of what they do. And we now have places like the Center for Humane Technology that are serving this role as an outsider to companies. But really, companies need to build it from the inside as well, because we see a lot of bad acting out there, intentional and unintentional.
Yeah, we certainly do. We certainly do. So philosophy, cool.
Yeah, philosophy. But I had some skills as a programmer, and I had some ideas. And when I got out of college, interest rates had just dropped, and my cousin was interested in starting a mortgage brokerage. And so he invited me back to take part in that. And I started a mortgage brokerage with him in the early mid-90s. And I wanted to move it online. And it was a little early. This was just the very beginnings of the web. There was no bank who would talk to us about originating over the web. It was a tough sell. We actually put some pieces in place to do automation through real estate agents' offices. And the idea was to drop a originator into real estate offices so people could get qualified on the spot. We did that and built that out into a small network in Kansas City. But mortgage banking and the mortgage brokerage industry was not something that I wanted to remain connected to for a long time. And the draw was out here to the West Coast. And we had sort of shot our load in terms of our the initial funding that we had to build a big network, and could still make a small brokerage successful out of it, but it wasn't for me. I wanted to get back out to the coast, to get to California. It was 95. The web was starting to really ramp up. And so I came out here. Out here, I'm in the Mill Valley right now, but out in the Bay Area.
Right.
To start a VR company with some other co-founders that I had met back in the Midwest. But three of us, and a fourth one joined us a little bit later, moved out here together, two from Chicago, myself from Kansas City, to start this VR company. And we didn't really know what we were doing, but we got an initial gig doing some work for a publisher out here. VR was way, way, way too early.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, back then. The web was just brand new back then.
And so that learned a ton in that business. It really lasted for about a year and learned a lot about relationships and what to do and what not to do. And then needed to move on. And I went to work for another entrepreneur and helped him sell his company to Motorola. And you know, that was my first exposure to a big company at Motorola. And great experience working for the company. The company's name was Ring Zero Systems, and our product was Ring Central. And Ring Central was a all-in-one communications device for PCs that we sold to OEM manufacturers of PC, IBM, Acer, HP, all the Compaq, all the big ones back in the day. And we sold that to Motorola. And then after Motorola bought the company for, I think, $16 million, they killed the project. Motorola was, it's about 3 months into it and they killed the project. And that was, it's been $16 million. And then
I never get that. So that happens a lot, actually. It's shocking.
Yeah. It was, it was first experience. I didn't know anything coming out of college, and I began as president of a company, and I learned business from a family sort of business perspective initially. And then at Motorola, it's like you're 8-9 layers below where any real decisions gets made. And so I had enough of that in a few months' time. And so rolled out with a few folks who had been with me at the previous company and a few folks that we had met at Motorola, and we started Corrigo. And that was a long roller coaster journey of about 20 years. It ended for me last April, finally.
Wow. So, 20 yeah. years.
20-year startup, yeah. We sold, Corrigo got sold to Jones Lang LaSalle JLL in December of 2015. Yeah.
Wow. And so wow. So, okay. So 20-year startup. I mean, that's pretty, it's a lot, long time. Most people roll in and out of a startup a couple of years. Some of the ones that, have been the quote unquote most successful, maybe last 5 or 6. What was some of the challenges going through all that? I mean, let me step back. What was the product that you guys did with that company?
So we were working, we got rolled when Ring Zero Systems got rolled into Motorola, we worked for the Lexicus division in Palo Alto, off Page Mill. And the Lexicus division, I'm not even saying that right, produced mobile data devices. And what we knew from that experience was that we didn't know exactly the form or the shape, but you would soon be able to walk down your corner AT&T store and buy a device that would have data on it. And so knowing that, we tried to figure out what could we do with that. And we really didn't foresee the iPhone exactly, but we knew these data devices would be ubiquitous. And so the idea was, one of my partner's family was in real estate, and I had some background in real estate, residential real estate at that time. And they did large property management for large residential units. And so knowing that we had an entree into that market, we looked at what could be done on site with wireless work orders. And so the idea was basically wireless work orders to mobile data devices to tell people, hey, go fix the toilet in, apartment 302. And so we started there in 99. Probably not, in retrospect, it wasn't the wisest of place. Real estate is a laggard industry.
Yeah, by a lot.
But it was, we had entree, and we we shot out of the gate, and in 99 and 2000, we had people just throwing money at us. And it was a wild ride. I think in about, certainly less than 3 years, we went from nothing to tens of millions of dollars in investment. We had purchased another company who had been in business for a decade or more doing similar stuff, grew to 130 people. And then when the investment, the VC who had led a round was going to put into the round in two tranches, when that VC basically evaporated in this was 2000, early 2001, and the second tranche never materialized. We went from 130 people down to 16 overnight. Wow. And had to figure things all out again as we were all taking support calls at our homes.
Oh, yeah. That's insane. I mean, that was, 2000, I mean, 99, 2000, the peak of the bubble, internet bubble, right? I mean, if you lived through that, you knew like what craziness was. I mean, now the 2008 bubble as well. And now obviously the 2020 COVID fiasco.
2020 to 2023 or whenever.
Whenever it's going to end, right? I mean, I wouldn't call it a fiasco. I shouldn't say that because it's not a fiasco. We have to do what we have to do. But living through that, like going back from what, hundreds of people down to 16. I mean, that takes a toll.
Yeah, it did. It did. And it took a long while for us to sort of climb out of that hole. And it took a long while for us to, get to a point of stability. And, we would have, there were a couple of lucky things that happened along the way. But foremost was in 2004, I think it was, I'm not exactly sure the timing, but we moved to a recurring revenue model. And so we moved from sort of a old school enterprise sale. So we started in 99 as a cloud-based service. And that was very early for enterprise cloud service.
That's the beginning.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things proudest of the work that we did there was the technical achievements that we had in terms of keeping a cloud service running up over 60 some odd major releases over that 17, 18 year time span. Wow. But moving in 2004 to a recurring revenue model really saved us. Because we went from this real up and down, we're dependent on the next gig, and therefore it's an enterprise sales, and they want these things looking this way and these things looking this way, and we have to, in order to get the deal, we're going to have to make these changes to the application, to just having that recurring revenue, and that really saved us. And we brought in a few professional managers to take over, to replace the CEO. And that really got us to a point where we were able to move forward through cash flow and building our own business. And so,
wow. And that was 2004.
Well, the 2004 was the change to recurring revenue.
Yeah. Model. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like,
and then it took us another while to learn economic discipline.
So for those of you that are listening who are a little younger than Gregory and I, 2004, a recurring revenue model in 2004 was almost unheard of in terms of like a SaaS cloud-based thing. I mean, it just didn't, I don't even think AWS existed back then. I mean, right. I mean, this is like literal the first time these things are happening. I mean, just imagine that. And nowadays, like you spin a cloud up, spin a server, AWS, you literally get it for free almost, right? Back then, you guys probably had your own hardware, your own, your own iron somewhere in some server room where you got to like worry that it's not going to blow up.
Yeah, no, we still did. For we only began really migrating to some of the cloud-based services much later, within the last 3 years or so. just because we had built a skill set around doing that and doing that really well and having it in our own data center. So,
yeah, people think data center. I don't even know what that looks like.
We did.
Yeah, no, well, it's funny because, and this is total tangent, but an aside, but sometimes as you scale up and you're doing more cloud services, AWS type services, there reaches a point where it's cheaper to build your own hardware. It's literally cheaper if you've got enough scale, literally go to a data center and like have it dedicated because, and there's some, obviously you got to be at that economy of scale, but there's a lost art in that. So, wow, like you're like the pioneer in cloud services starting 99. Wow. And then move into the recurring revenue model in 2004. So that's a lot of change and a lot of, I mean, there's just a lot that you've gone through. Like, I mean, the evolution of this company has gone through, I mean, 99, then 2004 transition of recurring revenue, 2008 recession. You know, and now, I mean, you sold a couple of years ago, but now it's like the 2020 recession or whatever. What are some of those lessons? Like, how'd you adapt all that change? Because it's a lot of change. I mean, and that's, we're all about entrepreneurs. We're all about, you know, managing the change. How did you handle that?
Take things one step at a time and prioritize and find good people. I mean, I think we had a great team, a team of people who really believed in each other, and we were able to, the average, when I left, the average tenure on my team was something like 8 years or so.
Wow.
There's people that I left working with that I had worked for, I'd worked together with for 24 years.
Wow.
24 years. And so in the Valley, you just don't get that sort of thing, right?
No, you don't. So do you think that was sort of the secret or one of the secrets to handling the change? Is that sort of continuity of talent?
That was part of it. The continuity of talent, the ease we had with each other, the knowledge that we could trust each other, the ease of communication between us, how we would, could just communicate very nuanced and complicated things in simple shorthand because we had so much shared background. And so I think that was helpful. Continually searching for, where we would find signal in the marketplace. We sort of drifted across markets. We started out, as I said, in residential property management, moved to commercial property management, and then went into retail, and then went into restaurants. And from there, ended up going into sort of third-party property management services. I think there are a lot of lessons to be mined from that. One of the things was we built an enterprise application, but we built it to support a number of different verticals or a number of different, they're different real estate verticals, right? They're not fully verticals. But that allowed us to be very flexible as a system and do everything not through customization, but through configuration. Hmm. And we built a highly configurable system that way that also ran smoothly and according to a very very straightforward, easy to understand workflow. The other piece of that was as we went into these different markets, we started to identify where we could get good. That allowed us to not be beholden to any one industry. And so in 2008, it was ironic, but the one market that we really got deep in, and by deep, I mean, we had something like four of the top 10, companies in the country, using our product was home builders. Hmm. And we really had a thriving business in the homeowner industry in 2007 leading up to 2008. And then, of course,
boom.
And then the bottom completely dropped out of that and they were gone.
Wow. I'm always impressed because by people who've gone through like these trying times, because I mean, my career, you know, started in 95, went through the 99, 2000 recession, went through the 2008, you know, there's all these, you just feel like, oh, wow, not again. You sort of know kind of what's going on. But yeah, to like have all this, man, we're just crushing it in construction. And all of a sudden it's like, no more construction. Boom. Yeah. Wow.
So yeah, I mean, the one, you know, real learning from this, we did learn it there in construction, the learning was we had been selling into the expense side of companies, and selling as an enterprise software into the expense side. We were selling to facilities, which was the sort of lowest rung of the corporate hierarchy in terms of power and juice in order to be able to make decisions, right? When selling enterprise, if you're selling into finance or you're selling into HR, then you have people who are really willing to listen. The facilities is really down there.
Their operations is never, they're 5% of the, when you look at the whole thing, like sales, marketing, finance, HR, development, ops, all the way down. Yeah. They're the cheap guys.
So that was always a challenge. And when we moved to the top of the ledger, when we moved to the profit side by going to third party service, you know, property management services companies, that changed the game. And that was sort of like what we were doing in the home builders, is that we were operating at sort of the customer interface level, where it's really about revenue generation, how well you could please your customer. And in the case of home builders, it was the warranty service arm of it. It was, you know, 30 days after you've bought your new home or 90 days after you've bought your new home. But it really, that sort of customer service really played into referrals for them.
Oh, and yeah.
So big. Very important. Super to get big. Keep the customer very happy. And same thing with property management services. You're doing the exact same thing, but all of a sudden you're working with people for whom this is revenue. This is revenue generating opportunity, not just sort of the bottom 3-5% of expenses, right? So that was a big learning for me. You know, it was just how different everything changed when we started, you know, because all of a sudden we had access to the C-suite where we really didn't before. And that's where decisions get done.
Yes. Yes, indeed. You always want to be the best friend with the finance, the finance guy or the marketing sales guy or gal. They're the ones that are generating revenue. I like that. That is a lesson. The make sure you're on the revenue side, like you're helping generate revenue as opposed to lowering costs, which is not bad, but I mean, that's the more growth is on the revenue side. I think it's always been that way. I've actually seen that as well in some of the companies that I've worked at. You know, it was a great idea, but we were always like, we're going to make it more efficient. Yeah, maybe, unless it's like a requirement or a regulation. But, you know, people want to generate more revenue. I'm going to make them generate more revenue. It's a harder sell. Not to say that there's not a lot of great companies doing operational efficiency, but just way harder when you're not
directly tied to it. Yeah. And particularly when change management gets involved, right? When you're not only having to write the checkbook, but you're having to get people to work together to change embedded processes and things that have worked. You know, people ask, why are we changing this? It's always worked for us before. You know,
way we've always done it. That's a lot big one in healthcare. Because I was, you know, at a healthcare company, and boy, just, they are like, we've been doing it this way forever. Why do we have to change? Unless the government, we'll look at healthcare. I mean, yeah, that's actually a really insightful thing for young entrepreneurs to realize is are you on the revenue generation side or are you on the efficiency side? Because it's a harder sell on the efficiency side. It's a harder sell, like, making irking, you know, are you going after the guys with the 5% of the budget, or are you going after the gals with the 100% of the revenue requirement? You know, like they want to make more money or they want to do more sales.
Absolutely. And you need to have a very easy return on investment story to tell, right? And the speed at which that gets implemented and the amount of pain that people are willing to take on in order to get the change to occur is much, much lower than they would to bring in additional revenue. And so it's all part of the calculation.
So after 20 years, you sort of sell the company, you leave, and you go off and do something else.
Yeah, go off and do something else. I mean, I really, really appreciated the last 3 years that I was there under employment contract, and we got purchased by JLL, Jones Lang LaSalle. And, you know, in comparison to this other Chicago-based company, Motorola, JLL was a fantastic company to work for. And it really was my first exposure to sort of a big company done right. And they've got their problems as well.
Oh, yeah. Everybody does.
But the way they treated us, the way it went through, it was a polar opposite experience than the Motorola acquisition. And so I really liked that because it meant a lot of good people, you know, in corporate doing good work, and that was fulfilling to me to have that experience. And you know, from a product guy's perspective, which was my role in the company, it was also exciting because we went from always being you know, sort of beholden to our sales and marketing to sort of drive things. All of a sudden, we got purchased by this company that had, you know, 100 of the, you know, global 500 companies that they're doing turnkey real estate for. And so basically overnight we had double, triple the number of users. And so that was thrilling as well. So enjoyed those last 3 years. They were fun.
So yeah, now you know what Zoom feels like right now.
Oh no.
Oh my God, we 10x'd over. What just happened? You know, I mean, they're having their problems, right? But yeah. As anything grows, that is so tough and painful. You see all where all the bodies are buried when you start to grow super rapidly.
Yeah, sure. All the little chinks in the armor become big problems.
Huge. They become huge. So
yeah, I that was a great experience, but I had spent 20 years in facility management, and it really wasn't I like and a lot of great people in that industry, but I wanted to do something that was more closer to my heart. And so started looking around and talking with a bunch of people, and went back to an idea that I had 8 years or so ago, and moving more into the mental wellness, behavioral health side of things. Really focused on helping people heal, and using using community and group aspects of group dynamics to help people heal. And that's really been sort of the central thread of what we've been trying to do for about a year now. This in May of last year, and I met my partner in August, and we've been working in the VR space in experiences of interpersonal exchange that helps with healing. I mean, deep forms of interconnection that we can support through immersive technology. And it's been an exciting time, and we've met some great people, and we've recently partnered with a group out of the University of Bristol, who we had been working on a prototype, and learned a lot about what's possible in VR and about sensor technology and what you can do with heart rate variability and you know, how we can modify things for people. But we were working with a group of developers who came out of the gaming industry, And a lot of VR that you see today is it's got a look that comes out of the driving engines of those things. And it never really was resonant to, you know, even ourselves as users in a way that we felt it could be if we had the right sort of underlying engine. And that's what we found with this group out of University of Bristol. And so actually what they had been working with was exactly the thing that we were sort of looking as a prototype for. And we met them in February and started working together. And we now have the first North American installation of what they built in their lab. And we're hopefully, as soon as the shelter in place orders are lifted, we're going to start to run users through our experience here and collect data and go from there. And so I'm really excited about this project. It's got some neat things associated with it.
Yeah. I mean, can you expand a little bit about kind of the underlying science behind it and sort of what, I mean, your timing's pretty much perfect when it comes to healing the world, because the world's going through a lot of collective trauma right now. No ands, ifs, or buts about it. When we get through the other end of this, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to need a lot of help. There's no doubt. You see that in so many ways. So can you explain a little bit about kind of how it works and what you're trying to do?
Sure. So what we've done is experiences of deep interconnection. And what we knew was possible, although we were having a hard time coming up with the prototype, is to create experiences. We've always looked at VR and said, look, I don't want to do the same thing that I can do in real life. Real life is so much more high def than VR will ever be. What I want to do in VR and the cool things to do in VR are the things that you could never do in real life. And so how do you create experiences that are beyond what we can do in real life? And so what this is our new partner coined this term pneumadelic for pneuma, spirit, and spirit manifesting. And the idea is that you go into this experience and you can experience other beings as their essence. And it basically takes people out of their identity and puts them together with other people and with this other being that allows them to connect in a way that really shows people their core human essence, as opposed to sort of all the surface and all the identity stuff that we get bound up with every day. And so people have these really amazing experiences on this. The intent was to create what's called a mystical experience, something that is akin to a direct spiritual experience. And the data that has been collected using this prototype so far is that it's similar. It's a totally different experience than a psychedelic, but it produces similar mystical type experiences to a fairly significant dose psychedelic. And that was the intent, is can you give people a completely perspective shifting sort of experience in about an hour's time that gives them connection to something that's beyond themselves, that's greater than themselves. And that's what we think we've achieved in this, in this prototype. We've got a lot of work still to do, but that's the promise, is that people can come in and have truly transformative, perspective shifting experiences that can help them create meaning and see themselves and others in a different light and really connect them with something outside themselves. You know, all of us are so tied into this vision of ourselves at the center of everything. And you know, really connecting with something outside of ourselves. And particularly as we try to do this, is use the technology to turn people towards the real world, to the natural world. And that's the attempt is instead of pulling people more into their own identity, pull them out and connect them with something greater than themselves. So that's what we're working on.
And, wow. That's pretty intense. I mean, you're the first person that I've ever met that's trying to do something like this. And I know there's a lot of research around this. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit much to take in. I remember when you first talked with me about this idea, I couldn't figure it out. Because again, I think it's because of the way we have to sort of shift our thinking about how, who we are and how we fit in the world. And the thing that's really, I think, directly applicable of what you're doing is there has been a lot of research on people that have gone through trauma or having difficulty, that especially PTSD, end of life, there's a lot of people that are working on this sort of thing. Do you see this as sort of a complementary to like a therapy practice where you have a therapist and you know, you're sort of... It's hard. It's a hard thing to kind of grasp because, you know, there's different modalities of therapy. Therapy is important in some aspects. Different types of therapy do different things. How do you see this fitting in? Because it's a totally, I mean, this is totally new. Like literally, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we see it definitely as complementary. Complementary to, cognitive behavioral therapy, complementary to some forms of, substance abuse recovery. And I can speak a little bit about that because that's I am not a trained therapist and not a doctor. And I don't have a big background on this. I have personal experience with therapy and personal experience with substance abuse issues, which have been sort of my personal issue. And, the 12-step program, which has been successful for quite a few people, and it has its adherents and its detractors, but it is something that can be helpful for certain people, and has been quite successful in a number of cases. And there's different bits of that that are successful, and one of the things that really brought it home for me is that part of it is certainly the interpersonal relationship, the that you build with your sponsor, and that's key, I think, to the 12-step program. But the 12-step program itself has a significant portion of the steps are founded in this idea that the individual believes in something that's greater than themselves. And whether you call it God or spirit or whatever it is, something greater. And, I think in our secular world today, a lot of people don't have a conception of what that is and don't have any form of, have never had any form of direct spiritual experience. And so, simply having this sort of experience, which can open up your mind to say, seeing that there is a world greater than me, and the world is more than what comes in through my eyes every day. There's something more, a little bit more, something there. It's a little bit more. That can have a profound impact on the way that people see themselves and how they act in the world. And so, Bill W., the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, forerunner of the 12-step program, there's quite a few reports of this, but he, in the 50s, he went through LSD therapy, and he believed that LSD was one of the keys to helping addicts recover because he saw this direct connection that people who haven't grown up in some sort of spiritual background could find that through LSD and that would help form a cornerstone of their recovery process. And I think that's true. And I've spoken with a lot of people who believe that to be true. And we're seeing real good science being done on the benefits of psychedelics to be used in addiction recovery. But you know, psychedelics aren't for everyone, and they can be unpredictable in their use, and certainly not something that you would want to give to a kid. And so there are cases where they aren't, and certainly in somebody who's maybe going through drug substance abuse issues, you don't exactly want to give them a drug, even though psychedelics are not for use. It's not exactly the right thing. But to give them technology, which can give them not the same experience, but similar sort of insight into how to see the world differently, can be helpful, but it's definitely complementary to all the other things that happen. So complementary to a 12-step program, complementary to cognitive behavioral therapy. But that's what we see it as, is something that can give people a significant change in perspective that they work with their therapist to then use that as a building block for their new life, however that life's going to be. Is that a good answer?
That's a great answer, actually. No, I mean, there's a lot of people that are searching for that. I mean, you know, addiction and trauma, people go through a lot of challenges and struggles with life. And, you know, this is what it is. I mean, I've abused substances before to handle my grief, and I don't do that anymore. And part of that's been because of the therapy, the recognition that this isn't good for me, and really getting down to the core of, well, what am I missing? You know, what is it about the experience I'm going through? Why am I doing this? And I think having a toolbox of all sorts of different tools to help people, I mean, because not one size does not fit all, right? Like you said, it's for some people, it's not for some people, but to have like a nice toolbox of therapies, methods, things to try, because we're all different people. Some people get motivated by different things. Some people don't. Some people, you know, they have a different root cause as to why the addiction's there, why the sadness, why the depression. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. And again, I'm not doctor. I don't have no idea. I just know what works for me. Yep. And I also know that there's a lot of therapists that are struggling to find ways to help people. And it's only going to get worse. And it's only going to get worse because of the situation we're in that's exposed the huge amount of challenges people are undergoing. But also, mental health's been swept under the rug for a long time. And can't sweep it under the rug anymore. It's just going to accelerate. You can tell that. So I think what you're doing is pretty cool. I mean, I can't wait to actually experience it. That'd be great.
I'm going to put you on the list.
Yes, please do. Please do.
We can start having people over, but get you on the list and have you experience this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the bigger picture sense of things, one of the things that, I've personally gone through in the last 18 months, quite a evolution. You know, I was working in this company, and JLL is a very, sort of corporate America sort of company. And walking out of there sort of began to expose me to a whole other side of life and people, and look at things from a very different perspective. And of the many things I've learned, one of the things that's been most helpful to me has been the writings of Charles Eisenstein. Are you familiar with Charles Eisenstein?
No.
So he wrote a book called Climate. And in it, he talks about, which I highly recommend, he's talking about our ecology and the ecological devastation that we're taking our planet through, and he creates a very simple argument that humans evolved in this world where they had a very close relationship with the natural world, and the the way that we evolved in tribes as hunter-gatherers. We had extremely close relations with everybody in that tribe. We knew all the details, intimate details of their life. And our understanding of place was extremely deep but limited. We only knew sort of the places that we went, but we knew everything about them.
Yeah, totally.
All the birds, all the insects, all the plants, we're dependent on the sun and the moon. And we had this extremely close relationship to all of the systems that were functioning around us. And what Charles uses the term, the story of separation. And as science has brought us a lot of great things. But prior to science, it was philosophy, right? It was natural sciences. But it was this idea that humans are somehow apart from the world of nature, the world that actually created us. And that this has been reified through the scientific method as we've become more and more removed from the systems that actually support life. And if you think about, going to the grocery store and going to a fluorescent lit grocery store and all the bright packaging on the shelves that you look at, how removed that is from actually the plants that grew that or the animals that had to be slaughtered in order to create that. And that removal, that story of separation is in part something that we've just in our modern lives have embodied and don't think anything of, but it's created this separation that allows us to be willing to go along with ecological devastation but at the cost that it's going to cost us all significantly, and it's costing, several species. Anyway, I don't mean to be on a monologue about this, except that this basic idea that we are somehow separated from the world, which is very life affirming, in which we evolved. We believe at Sodalicio, my new company, that that act of separation, that piece of separation, is in a large part one of the driving problems for the mental health issues, the mental health crisis that we see today, that people are not in the same sort of deep relations that they had with their family or their, the friends that they depended on or the earth around them. And this, even though we have these myriad communication tools that are ostensibly intended to keep us closer connected, they don't. They're all surface level sort of connections. They're not these deep connections. And what we're trying to do is paradoxically use technology to help reinforce those sort of fundamental connections between people in hopes that will help people, help them heal. And so that's a long-winded, very how do I describe it? I don't mean to be so heavy-handed in it, but we believe there's something fundamental here, and that the way that the world needs to operate in a going forward way is not the way that extractive capitalism wants us to move forward. We have to change things, and COVID is a virus, and it came about through natural processes, most likely, and but it's a sign, and it's something to listen to figure out, hey, maybe we're not going down this the right way, and maybe we do need to make changes. And so that's part of the hope behind Sodalicio is how to move forward in something that's not business as usual extraction.
Wow. Well, Gregory, that's a great place to end. I really appreciate your time, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what you guys come up with, because I do think we need to be more connected, and hopefully this will help.
Yeah, I hope. Great, Jari. A lot of fun. Great being with you.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA, and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.